Welcome to Global Fixed Interest. And our topic is, if cash is king, who will see the emperor's new clothes? Now, we have a team of experts here this morning, and they're going to talk to us about why global fixed income is an important consideration for a client portfolio. And they're going to highlight the risks of both cash and fixed income investing and tell us how to position those risks and how to position the opportunities with clients. Now, I'd like you to please welcome Paul O'Connor. Paul's from Standard & Poor's, and our partner host today, who's Charles Wall from Putnam Investments. And Charles is now going to introduce our speaker.
Thank you, everyone, for coming today. I think you can hear me without this. Yep. Both Pete and I work at a company called Putnam Investments, and if you haven't heard of Putnam, they're a Boston-based investment company. They've been around for global equities, and more lately, total return. Now, today, as you've heard, we're speaking specifically about global fixed income markets. And the team, the investment team that stands behind what Peter is saying is a team of 100 people based in both London and in Boston. They would manage roughly about $70 billion. 100 people, $70 billion, they're just big numbers. What does it mean to you? What it means is that when we're talking about things, the guys have got the skill and experience . One of the messages you get out of what's going to come today is, on one hand, the markets are difficult and distressed, but on the other hand, if you are truly a patient investor, there's never been a better opportunity to invest in these markets than what's available right now. Anyway, so we'll get Pete to come up and talk to you about, if cash is king, who will see the emperor's new clothes?
Thanks, Charles. A couple of people have asked me over the last 2 weeks, what the hell is your topic about? It's confusing to some people, and I guess to make that, or put it into some context, I might just remind people of the story about the Emperor's New Clothes, because it's become apparent to me now that not everyone knows that story. So I'll have to be honest, I'm going to stand out here and tell you a fairy tale. Not many people admit that, but I have to also say that that's going to end in the first couple of minutes. Beyond that, the fairy tale ends and the presentation itself is going to start. So the story of the Emperor's New Clothes is story by Hans Christian Andersen, goes back to 1837, and it's about an emperor who was very proud of how he looked and very proud of what people thought of him. And people got wind of this, or a couple of swindlers got wind of this, and so they let it be known around town that they were the best tailors in the world. They could stitch cloth that was so fine nobody could see, and they could put it together in a way that the wearer couldn't even feel the clothes. So, of course, the emperor heard about these people, summoned them to his court, and had them make clothes for him. One thing that they said, though, the stuff is so fine and so good that people that aren't fit to hold their position can't see the clothes. And the king was obviously embarrassed at this thought, so of course, when they gave him the first fitting, he said, yes, this looks great, this is very happy with my clothes. And the next time he was a bit unsure, so he sent some of his advisors, some of his court, to go and see the tailors to check on the progress. To which the advisors came back and said, yes, the clothes look great, they feel lovely and they feel really good. No one was willing to admit that the clothes weren't actually there and the clothes didn't exist, because no one wanted to feel that they weren't in the position that they should have been in. So this farce went on to the point where finally the emperor had his new clothes, paid a grand fortune for them, was parading down the street in his new clothes, completely starkers. And it took the innocence of one little kid to put his hand up and say, hang on, the king's naked. And at that point, the whole town laughed and realised the whole thing, that the kid was actually standing there completely exposed. Hence the story of the emperor's new clothes. And the reason I think I make this analogous to the story now is that we've seen a situation where a huge amount of money is going into cash and term deposits. And even, and I guess the thing that sort of incited this whole paper in the first place for me was the fact that a lot of the platforms are now adding term deposits to their menu, something that's been talked about for years. Most of them have been reluctant to do that. Now, finally, the last few months, we've seen a significant number of the major platforms add term deposits in response to advisor demand, which, of course, is in response to client demand. So this has been going on. And some of the anecdotal evidence is showing the volume of money going into that. One of the larger platforms that's had it on for 3 or 4 months, I'm told, has attracted already almost $1 billion in term deposits through that platform. So there's no denying the weight of money that's gone into it. But I'm going to talk a little bit about the weight of money, where some of that money's going, talk to you about the opportunities in fixed income and why we should be focusing on it as an asset class, talk about some of the risks. That's obviously relevant, but not just the risks for fixed income, the risks for cash and risks for term deposit. They're often talked about as riskless assets, but that's not necessarily the case. So I'll highlight some of those. And then finally, and this is, I think, the most important thing for the advisors in the room, is help you give you some ideas or some thoughts or even some tools, and one of those is sitting on the chairs, which I'll work with you later on in the presentation. So if you haven't got one of those coloured things, please grab one during the presentation. some tools that I hope you'll be able to use with your clients to help them understand the approach to global fixed income and perhaps why cash may not be king forever. Okay, this looks at the changes in net funds flow. So it's the market share report, the Morningstar market share report, and it's the 12 months to March, which is the most current available report. The bar on the far right, this one here, total shows, the blue bar shows the 12 months to March 07, the red shows the 12 months to March 08, so 12 months later. And you can see that about $10 odd billion went into wholesale managed funds. These are the funds that are listed on platforms, the one that most of you are putting your business into. So about $10 odd billion went into wholesale managed funds during both of those 12-month periods. But you can see in the first 12-month period, just under $4 billion went into income sectors, mortgage funds, fixed income, both domestic and international, credit funds, hybrids, things like that, things in the broad income sectors, whereas about almost the same amount of money, almost $2 billion, came out of cash funds. So lots of money going to the income sectors through March 2007, lots of money coming out of cash for the same period. But we roll forward to the purple bar a year later in March, and you can see that, you know, almost the same amount of money came back out of fixed income assets to March this year. We all know why that's the case, but the bottom line is a lot of money is coming out, and a similar amount of money, sort of well over $2 billion, going into cash funds in the wholesale universe. So this, you know, this doesn't capture the term deposits. This doesn't capture the ING Direct and the Bankwest and these other high-yield accounts that people are also putting money in. This is just within the wholesale managed fund universe. There's a huge amount of money outside of this that we all know is also going into those other sectors. And as I said, the term deposits on one of the platforms is just one anecdote of all of that. That's the fact. That's where the money's actually going. But what I'm going to talk about now is some of the opportunities in fixed income and why you would have fixed income in a portfolio. And I guess I'll kick off talking about it from a very fundamental perspective. That's the risk-return perspective of fixed income in an asset class. And, you know, we have volatility of returns along here and returns up here. And we all know that, you know, a typical situation is that lower volatility means higher returns. And that's largely the case. This is for 5 years. Global shares doesn't look too flash at the moment. I think we all know that generally that's going to be up there. But the bottom line is the growth assets, equities, property, the more aggressive assets tend to be this side of the curve, you know, ideally higher returns, higher volatility, and the income assets, cash and bonds, both Australian bonds and global bonds, but the lower end, lower volatility, lower returns. Now, we accept that, and we accept that, and even though we know that volatility has increased in fixed income sectors in the last year especially, you can still see when it comes to them compared to growth assets, there's a much lower volatility. The returns aren't too bad, but the volatility is much lower. And this is why you have them in a portfolio. It's the diversification benefit. It's the fact that they perform, it sounds really simple, but the fact is bonds perform differently to equities. And that's exactly why they sit in most clients' portfolios or most diversified strategies or strategic asset allocation strategies. Looking at this another way is looking at the correlation. So I guess a more statistical way of looking at how those two work together. And if we talk about correlation, you know, a perfect correlation, two asset classes that perform exactly the same way have a correlation of plus one. So they do exactly the same as each other over time. Two asset classes that do the exact opposite of each other will have a correlation of minus one. So the relationship between two asset classes is going to be somewhere between plus one and minus one. And what you're looking for in terms of diversification is ideally the lowest correlation, so either a negative number, and the bigger the negative, the better, because the assets perform differently over time. And in this chart here, it's obviously the darker shaded areas are the things that have the higher correlation and the lighter ones have the lower correlation. In other words, the positive diversification benefits or the reasons for adding them in a portfolio together. One of the surprising things is listed property. If you look at listed property on there, it actually has amongst the highest correlations in that whole matrix with shares. So, you know, property's changed. It used to be a somewhat defensive asset class in some views. And that's now has, you know, almost a perfect correlation with equities. So it shows how much that sector certainly changed. But the biggest negative numbers on this table are with both Australian and international fixed income and their correlation with equities. So, you know, back to this chart here, I was talking, you know, almost theoretically saying that they perform differently to global shares. Well, this is the proof statistically that bonds perform differently to shares and do well adding them in a portfolio together. I'll move on now to talk about some of the opportunities in fixed income. And in doing that, I want to give a bit of a history lesson, if you like, on how the fixed income market has emerged over time. And this is quite a busy, very colourful chart, so I don't expect you to sort of drill down on the detail of it. But if you think of it this way, what this chart represents is the difference in spreads between various countries' bonds, 10-year government bonds. So, you know, put it simply, let's say Australian government bond 10-year bonds are at 7% and German government bonds are at 4%. The difference is 3%. So that's a 3% spread. So that would represent 3% on this chart. pretty simple. Just the difference in yield between one government's 10-year bond and another government's 10-year bond. The thing to look at is if you draw a line about here, about 1988, 1999, it's like there's two separate charts. One shows the differences in these spreads over time, and there was a big differential. You could make 6 or 8% by investing in one country's government 10-year bonds, pretty secure investments, with a yield of 6 or 8% above another country's 10-year bonds. And obviously the research behind that was whether you thought that country was going to go broke or not. But if you're talking about developed markets, then it's reasonably sound, it's a reasonably safe bet. And you were well rewarded for getting that right. You know, a huge 5, 6, 7% pickup wasn't unusual for picking the right country. Pretty simple decision. Top-down bet, I think this yield's attractive, I'm going to invest in that country. Roll forward to here, the scenario is very different. Firstly, the overall spread is much narrower, but there's not as much as divergence either. So the upshot of this, or the bottom line of this, is that the opportunities for active management has changed in that it used to be make the country bet, make the top-down bet, get it right, and you're fine. That's gone. That opportunity's gone. The market's changed. Something else has to evolve because, you know, you're not as paid off as well as you were for those top-down bets. A few reasons for this. Firstly, markets are more transparent. You know, central banks are being a lot more sensible and consistent with each other. You know, even some of the emerging markets are being pretty sensible with their monetary policy now. So you're not getting these big differences in countries' divergence in terms of the interest rates that they're offering. You know, globalization's part of that. More efficient markets are part of this. Information exchange, data availability, and the fact that people have got instantaneous access to the different yields in these markets and economic information means that there really is two different markets. So if you're looking at things the old way, of a top-down bet on countries, then it's not surprising that you would have a different view of fixed income and perhaps something that should be avoided or should be adopted in some instances, but because it's an older view. But the fixed income market's changed, certainly from that perspective. And another perspective it's changed from is the type and variation of securities that exist in that market. And again, we roll back 20 years, 1985, and pretty much you had government bonds, semi-government bonds. There was a couple of American credit or US credit or high yield type opportunities, and then there was mortgages developed, securitized mortgages. And over time, you can see that as this market's evolved, the number and complexity of securities that are available for fixed income managers to invest in is incredible. Coupled with that is the explosion of derivatives within this market, where today about 80% of the daily volume traded in fixed income markets is actually in the derivative markets, not in the physical markets, in the derivative markets. So all of these securities here and the alphabet soup that some people describe, you need to understand it, you need to be involved with it, because there's opportunities there that's a huge part of the daily volume that's taking place. So I guess, again, the bottom message here is this market's become a lot more complex with a lot more securities to choose from. So wrapping that up again, we look at the old world, you really had three bets. Duration, which is whether you thought, what you thought interest rates were going to do, pretty simply, whether they were going to go up or down, what the yield curve was going to do. Country bet, which countries you thought were more attractive in terms of their yield and how they were going to perform. And currency, similar to that, what you thought the various countries' currencies would do. That was the bets that fixed income managers had, and there's about 1,000 securities for them to choose from to implement those views, to implement those, take those bets. Now, with this more sophisticated market, we've got over 14,000 securities and a whole range of subsectors, specialist subsectors, that managers need to understand. So again, the old world of a top-down manager making a view on I think rates are doing this or I think this country's currency is doing this just isn't going to cut it. You need specialist knowledge. You need expertise in all of these specialist areas. Otherwise, you'll get caught out in what is a much more complex market. So what are the opportunities that we can exploit? Because think about the market. This is a very mature market. It's huge. We're talking a $1 trillion market. It's sophisticated. There's lots of players in it. How can there be inefficiencies? What could we possibly exploit in the fixed income market with such sophistication and such scale? Well, there's still some things that exist, and it's because these markets have some anomalies. And I'll talk through four of them anyway that I think is just insightful in terms of understanding how these markets differ. Currency is an obvious one. Not everyone that plays in currency markets is an investor. Not everyone that plays in currency markets is doing it to make money. Sounds silly, but you've got central banks doing various things with their policy that has nothing to do with making active returns on the currency management. It's to do various things relating to their own policies. You get exporters and importers that will just settle on the day of their transaction. They might receive payment in US dollars for something they've sold to America, and they just get that day, and they've got to change that over to Australian dollars. They haven't thought about whether they're going to make money or lose money. They just take their transaction and receive their payments. You get mining companies that want to hedge out settlement because they know their contract's going to settle in 2 years, so they'll hedge that exposure. But they're active in the markets, not so much to make or lose money, but to protect a particular position. And because of all these different players that aren't there to make money, that creates opportunities for those that are, people that are active in the markets, understanding some of these differences and understanding why there's people with different objectives are going to create different different views, and of course that means different opportunities. In terms of term structure, this is the old thing of, you know, basically what rates are doing, what you think interest rates are going to do and what the yield curve's going to do. That's still a great opportunity to make money, and we, even within that, the volatility of those rates is another area where people can make money. So there's opportunities there. That was an old way of making money in fixed income that hasn't gone away. It's still important, but it's an important source of alpha or source of extra returns that needs to be highlighted. The third one is credit, and we've heard a lot about that over the last couple of days. Credit is a great opportunity to make money, and the reason that exists is there's pretty much two ways that people play in credit markets. Firstly, I should point out, you know, it's very, very hard to model the credit risk accurately. No model can actually do it perfectly. It's very hard to do. So people make various assumptions to put together in a credit model that's going to, you know, based on certain risks and certain outcomes. And they tend to be quite tied to that model on one hand. And of course, if they're tied to the model and the assumptions need to change, there's some inflexibility in doing that. So that's on one hand, you get people that are very model-driven, tied to their models and inflexible on that. And at the other extreme, you get people that don't model the credit risk or don't attempt to, and they just chase yield. They just chase the company that they think offers the biggest yield on its bonds, the corporate bonds. So again, with these two different types of players in the market, there's opportunities to understand some of the differences in the models, some of the anomalies and some of the yield differentials, and capitalise on those and make returns. And the last area in terms of inefficiency is liquidity. And similar to currency, this is because there's people in the markets that have different objectives or different reasons for being in the markets. And liquidity I'll talk a little bit more about on the next slide when I talk about risk in fixed income. But the key with liquidity is that there are a number of people that operate in fixed income markets that are there for all the right reasons, but for different reasons they become forced sellers. A great example of these is insurance companies around the world that have huge amounts of assets invested in bonds that are basically to back their insurance liabilities. For example, if a storm happens or something happens where they've got to pay out the money, conservatively invested, and typically they have quite a rigid credit criteria on the way that fixed income is invested. You know, it can't fall below AA or something like that. So if something's downgraded for whatever reason, even if it's a short-term downgrade, a lot of those insurance companies have to get out of that security, regardless of their view on it, regardless of where they think it'll be in a year's time or 2 years' time, just because they've got internal rules that say you cannot hold securities below this rating. So they're forced sellers. And similarly, and this is a lot more common these days, where we've got, you know, leverage sellers, some of the hedge funds that are very heavily leveraged into fixed income markets that might have fallen in price, and they have to get out of that because they can't carry an active exposure. They've got performance fees based on this, and they might have a five-year view that security is great, but these guys are paid on much shorter-term time horizons. So a shorter-term time horizon forces them to get out of these markets. They're forced sellers, and like any market, if there's forced sellers, there's beneficial buyers at the other side of it. So that's a great way to make money in fixed income. Looking at this, another one, I'm just going to look at the risks in fixed income, and this is sort of the next part of this presentation. I've talked about some of the opportunities. That was more of a bit of a background or a 101 on fixed income type thing, but this is more about some of the risks. And I guess it's taking through the risks that we've seen, some of the things we've seen, and helping to understand those. And I guess what I'm leading towards is how to position these risks and perhaps some of the opportunities with clients, how you can actually talk to clients about these things. If we look at there's four risks I've got up here. The paper that I put together for this, which is published on the PC website, mentions a fifth risk, which is purchasing power risk or inflation risk. And that's one that obviously pertains to cash specifically, in that, you know, simply the rate of inflation eroding cash returns. And, you know, we know the cash rates now, let's say you're getting 8%. If that's discretionary money, it's not super money, let's assume that person's on the top marginal tax rate, they're going to be paying about 4.3% tax on that. And then, of course, the inflation rate's about 4.5%. So someone investing in cash, paying tax at the top marginal rate, is underwater. They're underwater. Yes, they're preserving capital, and as some of you would have heard Philip and Malcolm say yesterday, maybe, depending on the time horizon, the short-term time horizon, capital preservation is more important. But the key, I guess I want to get across, is the issue is around time horizon. If the time horizon is longer, why would you be invested in something you know is going to lose money this year? You know it's going to put the client underwater. Because according to 60% of you yesterday, or the surveys you said, 60% of you said that your client's time frames are more than 5 years plus in one of the workshops yesterday when that was put together. So if it's 5 years plus, you're putting client, well, why would you, you know, encourage clients to get to something that you know they're losing money now when they've got a longer term time frame? And time frame's the key driver there. And as I said, as I move on, I'll give you some ideas and some tools that will help have those discussions with clients, because it's a hard one. When someone's saying, why shouldn't I go into ING Direct at, you know, 8%, why should I invest in anything else? It's a difficult decision. So hopefully we can help you go through that. So that's a fifth risk, but I'll take you through these four risks here. Volatility or prepayment risk, that's sort of something more unique to US securities, but it's basically that if interest rates come down, investors can actually prepay their, sorry, interest rates go up, they can prepay their mortgage with no penalty. So there's a risk for that investor because they've then got to go and get refinanced, so they've got to go and find new securities. I'm not going to drill down on that anymore. Term structure, simple thing, if rates move against you. You know, if you're holding a 10-year bond that's at 8% and that the government issues new ones at 9%, well, your bond isn't worth as much as it was because someone can go and get the equivalent for with a higher yield the next day. So you lose money on that. And that's, again, it's an old risk that hasn't changed. The two I'm going to focus and spend more time on is credit risk and especially liquidity risk. Credit risk is all about spreads, credit spreads, and whether you think, you know, the way a company's risk is actually priced, i.e. how much you're being paid to hold a company's bonds, how much extra you're being paid or compensated in terms of the spread over cash or spread over other securities, is worth the risk that you might be taking in that. And in this market, that's a risk that's obviously got a lot of airplay, but really, this isn't a credit crisis that we've seen, it's a liquidity crisis. There hasn't been a lot of credit events. The credit events have been in the residential mortgage market in the US. But we haven't seen many defaults in the commercial mortgages. We've seen, you know, very few in the corporate market as well. So all this discussion about credit crisis and credit risk isn't so much the issue. It's all about liquidity risks. Now, I'm not saying there's not going to be credit risks in the future. There may well be. And it's always with these things, people tend to price in. Once they start to see the defaults, they then price that in. But at this stage, we haven't really seen the defaults. I'll show this in a little while. The thing I want to talk about is liquidity risk for two reasons. One, it's rarely talked about. It's not something you generally see in the papers. It's not something you generally see in fund manager commentaries. It's not often talked about. But this is what's driving markets today. It's liquidity risk. Basically, the difference between the value of a security and what it's trading at today. And as I said before, if your time frame's long term, liquidity risk is not something you have to worry about. Because if the security is fundamentally sound, what it's priced at today as opposed to what it's going to be priced in 10 years when you sell that security isn't really an issue for an investor. So it's in this market where liquidity risk is paramount that the investors are rewarded and the traders, as we've seen, are actually penalised. We're going to look at credit risk versus liquidity risk a different way over the next couple of slides. And this looks at high-yield corporates, lower grade or higher risk, if you like, corporate credit securities. And you can see here, you know, these things trade somewhere between 400 and 1,000 basis points spread. So what that's saying is what these companies need to offer as income to investors above the cash rate is somewhere between cash plus 4% and cash plus 10% over time. And what these things move in cycles, and what these cycles really reflect is the level of defaults that we've seen. And in this high grade market, we've got on this chart here, hopefully you can read that, low, average and high. The level of defaults, the low amount is about 1%, 3% is typical, 3% of defaults in total, and high is 5%. So the question is, you know, how much are you willing to be compensated? And I guess I'm not advocating high yield as a strategy, but one thing I just want to be aware of, you know, at the moment you're being compensated about 8% for something where the incidence of losses has been very, very limited. And even if it moves to high, the incidence of loss is talking about 5%. There's still a reasonable buffer there. And if you're, again, picking the right securities, that risk might be very well mitigated. We look at investment-grade corporates, and these are things, you know, high-grade corporates, things that have got much less risk of default. You can see here, as a result, less risk, they trade at a much narrower band, somewhere between sort of, you know, 50 and 150 or 200 basis points. So 0.5% and 2% above cash is what you are compensated for holding the risk of this sort of security. And again, the instance of defaults in a low scenario, it's marginal, negligible. Even in a high scenario of defaults, you're talking less than 0.5% of defaults in these securities, 0.5% loss, I should say. So again, quite reasonable compensation. But what we're seeing once again, you know, we're seeing this peak in 2003 where there were defaults, there were companies going broken, and similarly back to the high yield, there were companies that were going in difficult times, so they were defaulting on these loans and the spreads went up. But we've seen these spreads blow out to here, but we haven't seen the defaults. And the market's almost assuming there's going to be defaults that haven't come through. The question is, are they going to come through? And if they are you being adequately compensated for those? But this is the thing I wanted to focus on, and that's the fact that we're talking about liquidity risk and not credit risk. So looking here at liquidity risk, this is commercial mortgage-backed securities. Commercial mortgages in the US talk about industrial, office, retail, the whole basket is called commercial. So these are AAA commercial mortgage-backed securities. You know, absolutely very high quality, super senior, high-quality commercial mortgages in the US. The instance of default of these things is negligible. It's almost nothing. So these things don't default. They typically, and as a result of something that's a very large, very mature market, it's a very clean market. It's been around a long time. It's quite transparent, very well understood, very actively traded. It's a huge market. So as a result of all of that, you know, transparent market, very limited defaults, why would you be compensated for holding these securities? And typically you're not. Normally sort of somewhere between, you know, much less than 0.5%, somewhere between 40 and 50 basis points is what you're compensated for this risk, because the risk is negligible. But during this current liquidity crisis, what we've seen is these things blow out to, you know, they started off, they were trading at about 30 or 40, they traded out to 50. They went from 50 to 150. They went from 150 to 200. They went from 200 to 300 basis points. So something that typically trades 0.5% is what you're being compensated for the risk. You're now being compensated for over 3%. For the risk hasn't changed, there hasn't been defaults, and, you know, in our view, the likelihood of those defaults is hasn't changed. We don't think that's going to come through. But why are these things wearing the brunt of this? Because it's a mature market, it's a liquid market. Therefore, those four sellers we talked about before, the hedge funds, people that have sorts of exposure, you've got exposure to something that's very hard for you to get out of. You sell the thing that you can get out of, and that's these. So what they'll typically do is sell out of these securities or short these securities to reduce their overall exposure to mortgages or structured securities. And as a result, these great quality securities are being sold off. I guess, what I want to demonstrate here is that this is highlighting the fact that this is about liquidity, not about credit, because the credit securities haven't been sold off that much. The stuff that's actually high grade, this is has been sold off a lot, so it's actually a liquidity issue. It's a liquidity crisis that we're going through. How do you take this all to clients? You know, how do we position these things with clients? And what are some of the tools that hopefully we can help you with explaining to clients why fixed income might be relevant, how the fact that there are risks in cash and there are risks in term deposits. And what this shows you is the last bond crisis that some people would remember is back in 1994. This is when fund managers were dragged on a current affair in Four Corners and questioned as to how they can call their funds cap stable funds when clients lost money. Yes, clients lost money in bonds, and that was a shock to most people. They didn't think it could happen. But if we look at the one-year returns back then in 1994, you know, they lost a few percent in bonds and equities went up. And, of course, panicking at that point would have seen that crystallising that loss. But over the next few years, investors were rewarded for sticking with these bonds. You know, it's pretty simple. It's pretty straightforward. But the fact is, bond markets do go down. But that's definitely not the time to sell those markets. And a longer-term approach is obviously going to reward that. And this is another thing that I think is relevant, because everyone's talking about the subprime crisis. These, you know, people lending to people that can't afford to repay their loans, that's really bad. Well, it's bad, but it's part of capitalism and it's greed and it's happened before. That's the key. This is not the first subprime crisis we've seen. It's actually the fourth. So everyone's saying the world's going to end, the Chicken Little scenario, the world's going to end, it's all over, this subprime, these people lending to poor people in the US that can't afford to repay the mortgages, it's going to stop the whole world. Well, you know, we had the savings and loan crisis in the early 90s, we had an issue with home equity loans in the late 90s, same thing. Manufactured housing, that's the American term for trailers, or caravans as we call them. But, you know, this is people lending people money to buy a caravan that was more than the caravan was worth. That's real subprime stuff. And guess what? They defaulted. So, you know, this happens. But what this yellow bar chart shows, that during this time, the size of the mortgage-backed market grew. So every time these things happen, okay, there's a little bit of a blip. There's a smaller market there, so the blip's not as obvious. You can see there's a blip here. There's little blips in the market, but the market continued to evolve. So, the Chicken Little scenario, the world isn't falling, the sky isn't falling, the world's not ending. Markets continue to evolve, continue to grow despite these alleged crises. Now, I'm not saying that things are all rosy and it's all going to be great from here, but, you know, again, this is just something that you might be able to use with clients to help them through this scenario of this thing's really bad, this is going to hurt. Well, it's happened before, it's not the first time. And this is where I want to talk about this tool that I've got on the chairs for all of you today. This is something that we developed, again, hopefully that people can use with their clients to help them understand what's going on with these markets and some of these things. And it's called an alternating bond market leadership. And I think you're all familiar with the typical asset allocation for balanced funds chart. I think Perpetual put it together years ago, but it shows, you know, Australian shares, international shares, global bonds. And it shows that no one sector wins every year. The idea you need to be diversified, because some years bonds are going to be best, other years cash is going to be best, other years equities are going to be best. We've done the exact same thing with all the fixed income subsectors. So we've looked at high yield, we've looked at government bonds, Australian bonds, hedged international bonds, unhedged international bonds, mortgage funds, cash. All of these things to show that, you know, from here, no one sector is a consistent winner. So I guess there's a couple of key takeouts from this. You know, firstly, every single sector in that table finishes in either the top two or the bottom three. So picking a winner is very, very hard because these things are going to jump around from top to bottom. So you can't just be concentrated in one idea because you can't. It's very hard to pick that idea. Global bonds, which sort of sometimes talked down, have actually outperformed Australian bonds in 9 of the last 10 years, and I think 10 of those 12 years in this scenario. So they can't be ignored in a portfolio. Global bonds are an important part of that client strategy. High yield or credit, which again people were flogging like a dead horse 18 months ago, we see that it's just as likely to finish at the top of the table as it is at the bottom of the table. It's a very volatile asset class. It reflects what's going on in the economic cycle and tends to move up and down very highly. So it can't be your only bet. You know, if you're going to invest in diversified fixed income, it needs to be genuinely diversified across a whole range of things. It can't be just credit. Because we know now, you can see here clearly, and you can help clients see, credit is very volatile. And this is the really scary figure, the average difference between the best and last sector. So this is the average difference between the best and worst is 24%. So if there's one sector that's doing well, they're sectors you want to be in. Likewise, if there's sectors they're doing bad, you know, you hope that you've got the expertise to pick when to go in and out of them. And if you haven't, then you need to get a manager that can do that. But ideally, the more of these tools, if you like, the more of that opportunity set a manager can invest in, the better they're able to diversify that exposure and avoid the blow-ups, avoid some of the big negatives that can possibly happen in some of these sectors. I'm getting wind up here. I'll just wrap up quickly. I mean, here's, you know, summarising what I've talked about today, we know that there's a lot of money going into cash and term deposits. We're all aware of that, and it's very hard to convince clients why that shouldn't be the case in an environment where capital preservation for the very short term could be relevant. But again, I want to focus on the fact that, you know, typically these are long-term investors, and if they're taking a long-term approach, this is perhaps the best time or best opportunity they've had to invest in fixed income in 20 years, where the markets, they're being more than compensated for the risk, whether that risk is there or not, being more than compensated for the risk. And if the risk doesn't eventuate, there's a huge kicker. There's huge returns to be made on top of that. The thing that, again, to remind you, you know, cash and term deposits, despite what's often said, they do have risks. Cash has the risk of being eroded because of inflation. At the moment, with inflation at 4.5%, that's a very real risk. And term deposits have the risk that, you know, you might lock in for a two-year term deposit now at 8%, but when you come out in 2 years' time, what's going to be the prevailing interest rate? If it's down at 6%, you've got an inability to get the 8% that you had. And we all know that if a client's going to lock away at 6%, they're not going to hit their long-term objectives because that's not going to deliver on most of the objectives or goals that you're setting with your clients. As I said, the opportunities in fixed income are great, but this is really the time to, you know, position this with clients, help the clients understand the risks in fixed income and the opportunities in fixed income. And as I think you heard Philippa and Ruth say, to refer to my notes, but they were saying yesterday that this is the time where courage and conviction are key. So this is the time to be, you know, if we believe that the client is king or the client's the emperor, this is the time to be pointing out that they may not be wearing any clothes if they're in cash and term deposits. Maybe they need some new clothes. Thanks, and happy to take questions.
Thank you, Pete. Fire away, please.
Peter, John.
Peter Putnam.
I'm sick of that joke.
Got it. you talked about the difference between liquidity risk and credit risk. How can you actually, you describe that. Is there a way of measuring that? As in, how do you measure the effect of liquidity risk on the return of a, for example, on anything?
Yeah, I guess if you look back at those charts I showed, the issue with credit risk and liquidity risk is credit risk is that there's a real risk of something going bad, something defaulting and losing money. Liquidity risk is an issue is where the risk of actually losing money isn't bad, but people are trading things for various reasons, for sellers, all sorts of other things going on. Measuring it's going to depend on the time frame. Of course, you know, liquidity risk, there is no measurement if you're not selling that asset. Other people might be selling at a huge discount, and if you're, you know, most people mark to market, so you might say that you've taken a loss on paper, but unless you're selling out of those securities, there's no loss. It's a risk in terms of the volatility, but you're not actually losing money on it.
So you only know if liquidity risk is really credit risk if there's defaults in the future?
Well, it depends on the individual securities, because again, back to the commercial mortgage-backed securities, they're trading at an amount that would more than compensate for defaults. Yeah. Far more, so that's... even if they do happen, I'll go back to that chart, even if defaults happen, you're talking about the instance of, you know, the worst period in the history of these things, AAA CMBS, was between 1986 and 1996. That's when the underlying assets, the property, commercial property markets, went down by 50%. So the underlying assets halved in value. The incidence of loss during that period was about 5 or 6%. At the moment, you're being compensated more than 30%. So think about this. The underlying assets went down by half. The losses were 5 or 6%. So what would the underlying assets have to go down for now for the losses to be something like 30%? I don't know the figure, but it's an incredible figure. And even if there is defaults, even if we do get property prices halved, and even if there is defaults, you're being far more than compensated. And that's what I'm talking about, liquidity. Okay, these things might be, you know, maybe they should trade from there to there or there to there, but you're being compensated way up here. And these things have actually sold off back again to over 200 in the last couple of weeks. So you're being more than compensated for even if there is defaults. That's, I guess, what I'm getting at. That's where liquidity risk comes in.
Great. There's another question here. Has he? All right.
Oh, okay. Is he?
Peter, you mentioned earlier the diversification benefits of fixed income, mm-hmm. holding it in a portfolio. Have you got any comments to make about how correlated credit risk is to the equity market in general?
Yep. That's not one I looked at in that correlation matrix, but I mean, we know that credit risk is a factor of more a factor of company performance and economic performance, so it would have a much higher correlation to equity markets than the broader fixed income market. That, I think that's easy to say that. Yes, it would have a higher correlation. That's looking at Lehman Ag, so it would actually have a fairly low exposure. So maybe that exposure will be increased if you added in credit, but which is a fair point. But given that, you know, if you have only a credit strategy, that's going to change the argument. It goes back to what I was saying before. Credit is one idea. There's other ideas. The more you have, the closer you're going to get to that diversification benefit of fixed income, that lower correlation.
Ladies first.
Over the credit crunch that just incurred since last August, where we see that all the diversified multi-asset classes securities have actually correlated into one, which we believe that is supposed to have a uncorrelated between, like, examples, global property from, like, equities, or there's supposed to be a diversification benefits in multi-asset classes.
Yeah.
However, during these bear markets where we see all the asset classes have actually correlated into one, including, like, alternative fixed interest and hedge fund either as well. So actually, do you guys actually have a symptoms that measure this risk before that what is going to happen, or what is the diversification of having all those?
We do. There's two ways to answer that. I'll answer firstly talking about it from how we actually estimate risk in things we're investing in. We, with all of our securities we're investing, we apply blow-up models, which is basically assuming, you know, worst-case scenario across all of these things. What is that going to do to the scenario? And back to what I said before, are we being adequately compensated for that worst-case scenario? So at a security level, yes, we take into account situations like last year where, you know, everything lines up. And being aware of that risk was something that helped us deliver positive returns through that period. Going back to, I guess, your point about different asset classes from a multi-sector perspective and the different asset classes correlating, over that one-year period, that's definitely a very unusual situation where these things correlated quite significantly. Numbers I looked at were, I think, 5-year numbers or 10-year numbers, so a much longer-term period. And I guess you'd expect that those asset classes aren't going to stay correlated for the next 5 or 10 years. It's 1 year where they were correlated. The figures I include that data and still show that over a longer period it's not, you know, there's diversification benefit from being in these different things.
That sometimes we don't realise that we have actually have a numbers of bear markets more than what we expected.
Yeah, and in terms of bear markets, you know, again, that's where bonds typically do quite well in bear markets. So, I mean, last year was more than bear market. It was a complete market correction across the board with everything. And if depending on what happens going forward, you know, if you believe the economy is going to go turn around and go very strongly going forward, equities will do well. If you believe it's going to go poorly, bonds will do well. But either way, you know, you need that exposure to both to ensure that, because none of us know what the economy is going to do over the next year or two, so 3 or 4 or 5. So,
I guess the RAMS, for instance, is an example of where liquidity risk can mm-hmm. can extend into credit
yep.
risk. You mentioned diversification. Can you give us some insight into the type of and the size of a portfolio that you'd need to construct to get the benefit of diversification in this sort of environment?
Yep. You're talking from an institutional perspective in terms of a...
Well, obviously, I don't doubt we as advisors could put it together, given the RAMS type scenario, because I don't necessarily agree with you that it's only about liquidity risk. I think the flow-on effect, as illustrated by RAMS, suggests that there is credit risk associated with liquidity risk.
Yeah. Putting together a diversified fixed income portfolio now, there's different ways it can be done. With a smaller amount, I mean, when I'm talking small, I'm still talking from a fund perspective in terms of us putting a fund together as opposed to an advisor implementing it day to day. You know, something like $20 or $30 or $40 billion, $1 million would be enough that you could get reasonable diversification. But a lot of that would be using derivatives as proxies for some markets. Where you're talking about getting diversification, where you're buying individual securities, therefore diversifying, you know, your risk even further, you're probably talking $50 or $100 million as a sort of figure where that would be the sort of portfolio where you can get a complete diversified, you know, balanced risk to all of the opportunity set. And that's the key, all of the opportunity set rather than most.
And then your spreads become relevant in terms of the risk return sort of...
At the security level, yeah, and that's the key, at the security level.
Yeah,
as for putting it together from an advisor perspective in terms of using different funds and cobbling it together, I couldn't fathom it. It's obviously a lot of variables in that to work that out. So,
there was a question just up the back. Was that gone or...?
Great question. There's two parts of that. We hedge the portfolio back to Australian dollars because, you know, again, like most fixed income managers here, we're aware that your liabilities in Australian dollars, you don't want the currency risk as part of that exposure. But currency we see is actually a good source of extra returns. We think it's an asset class that you can make money in, and as a house, we're recognised as being a very strong currency manager and we've delivered quite well at adding those returns. So within the fund that we offer in Australia, the Worldwide Income Fund, yes, we hedge it back to Australian dollars, but then we have an allocation where we can actively invest in different currencies to make extra returns.
There's another question just here.
I wonder if you could give us a bit more of an insight into the credit risk. I mean, I take your point. Up to now, it's been liquidity risk, and people just haven't been able to raise the money in the period that they've got. But we've seen some enormous things, you know, Citicorp's written off billions off their balance sheet and had to refinance, and Bear Stearns has gone under, and the National Bank just recently wrote their so-called AAA securities down to might have been a bit of a rating risk in that one, but down to about 30% or something like that. I mean, obviously, people seem to be expecting much higher credit defaults than you could get by looking at the historical data.
Yeah, you're exactly right. People are expecting much higher than historical data would imply. Let's look at that's investment grade credit. So you can see here, you know, that's a very bad economic situation where companies are going bust. This is pricing that in now, even though we haven't actually seen that. We haven't seen the level of defaults. Now more than ever, security selection is important. You know, so this is looking at the broad market, but if you look at individual securities, there's going to be somewhere that's probably not enough compensation, the things that they could default. Others where that's far more than enough, and I guess that's what I'm saying. So security selection is so important now because there will be defaults, no doubt about it. But across the broader market, you're being more than compensated. And what that means is there's some great securities out there where you're being compensated because they're being put in with the basket of everything else. Where it's even you'll make even more than you should have or could have otherwise. So security selection is the answer to that. That's the key.
Time for one more, or is that it? One more? No, that's it.
That's it. Okay, I'll just do. I'm just going to do the quick wrap up of the product. So this is the non fairy tale bit, product bit. The Putnam Worldwide Income Fund is the fund that we offer. There's a bit about that on the back of the coloured flyer that I've put on the chairs. But this fund, you know, accesses Putnam's 100 strong, you know, long term track record, established fixed income team. So it's an absolute world class fixed income capability that underpins this fund. It accesses all of the fixed income opportunity set. That wheel I put up earlier that looked at all of the different securities and sectors that are available. Because we have a large team of specialists doing the stock selection, security selection at those levels, we can access every part of the wheel. So the broader opportunity set, just like this coloured chart shows you, the broader the opportunity set, the better you can actually capitalise on the good things and potentially avoid the bad things as well. The fund targets cash plus 3%. It's maintained positive returns over this difficult period, and whilst it was performing in line with cash, or actually above cash until, you know, some months ago, it's given a little bit back, but we're still delivering positive returns. And in a market where that's been quite difficult to achieve for any fund with any sort of fixed income exposure, I think that's a good result. But at the moment, we believe where markets are at, that is very achievable going forward. And in terms of the compensation, some of the stuff I talked about with some of the what markets are willing to pay people or compensate people for risks is greater than ever. So the opportunity now is what our portfolio managers are saying is the best opportunity they've seen in 20 years. They really haven't seen better opportunities. And the other thing I should say is the fund's highly rated by most of the major research houses, which is probably a nice research house mentioned to Paul.
Thank you. Paul O'Connor is just going to give us a brief wrap-up now on how to fit this product type into a client portfolio.
Thank you. Yeah, well, just very briefly, I guess something that's not news to anyone in the room here is the fact that I think in the Australian marketplace we've been looking for greater yield in portfolios probably over the last 7 or 8 years, and you know this has probably essentially been driven by the low inflation, low interest rate environment that we have been living in, and also the ageing population. Added to that is that over the last 10 years we've just seen a huge explosion in the amount of fixed income securities that we can actually invest in. I think Peter showed a chart earlier that that showed the security universe for is it the Putnam Fund, around 14,000 securities. So I guess it certainly makes sense from the Standard & Poor's viewpoint to have diversified income as a core component of your defensive allocation within a portfolio. But having said that, we know that the risks in fixed income investing are not symmetrical, and you know, essentially there's no great upside to investing there. So falling from that really is the fact that we believe you should have a very strongly diversified portfolio in terms of numbers of securities, diversified by region, diversified by industry as well. And I guess from that, given the complexities in this universe now, we believe that we're better off using a diversified income manager rather than actually making allocations to a credit manager and a high yield manager and a traditional sort of fixed interest manager. And then in terms of looking for managers, we're looking really for the depths of skills that they have across the entire fixed interest spectrum, and then also some level of ability to undertake valuation analysis across those various fixed interest buckets that you can invest in and add some value from an asset allocator viewpoint. So typically for clients' portfolios, we don't look to take on that role. And I guess that's it. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you all for coming along, and that wraps up our session. So please give a warm thank you to Peter and Charles and Paul. Now, just before you leave, we have to do the vote. Are we ready? We're ready to go. Are you going to put the little timer on? It doesn't work. Oh, there it goes. I did it.